I'm going to have to talk to your minister. Every time she invites me to preach, you're having a rummage sale. However, I did notice as I entered this holy place that it was obviously this service was going to be a shoe-in. So how many of you have been in circumstances where you needed to forgive yourself? Okay, Unitarian honesty. Now, how many of you have been in places where you needed to forgive others? Now, how many of you have struggled with forgiveness? Okay, I just wanted to be sure what I had to say was pertinent, otherwise I'd have preached something different. I grew up a Southern Baptist. I was in my third year of education in a large university when I was asked to be the minister of education, youth, and music in a church in a small nearby town. As I began this venture, I realized I had entered into a squabble of major proportions between the senior minister and a faction in the congregation. It started over something minor but had escalated into full-scale war. I sought to maintain a neutral position, hoping to be a peacemaker. But neither side was happy with this posture because it implied compromise rather than winning. And as the heat of confrontation intensified, so did irrational and destructive behavior. One Saturday morning, I was organizing for the Sunday service in the sanctuary, and I heard a ruckus in the back hallway. Upon investigating, I found the senior minister and one of the church deacons shouting at each other and about to come to physical blows. I stepped between them, pushed them apart, suggested they leave the building by opposite doors, and cool off. Pretty brash for a college student. I waited until I heard the doors close. And as I started to return to my work in the sanctuary, I heard one of the doors reopen. It was a deacon. With one hand in his pocket and the other poking the air in my direction, he came angrily striding down the hall and yelled, "Why are you siding with the minister?" As calmly as I could, I responded that I was not siding with anyone. I was seeking a resolution before the congregation damaged itself in some irreparable fashion. As I finished my response, I realized that the hand which had been in his pocket was now out, and in it, opened, extended, in my direction was a butcher's pocket knife with its 7-inch blade tarnished with blood. I was astounded when I realized that blood was gushing from my side. I was even more startled when I saw that he was tensed in an attack mode and was about to stab me again. We can all imagine how we might act under life-threatening circumstance, but none of us knows until it actually happens. As he tensed, I cupped my hand over the wound in my side, seeking to stop the flow of blood. I looked into his anger-reddened eyes and said, "At this moment, the charge against you will only be attempted manslaughter, but if you use that knife again, it will probably be murder. I don't think you want that. fold up your knife, put it in your pocket, and go home. He seemed shaken by these words, but remained tensely poised for what seemed to me an eternity. Then, to my amazement, he relaxed, took a handkerchief out of his pocket, wiped the blood off of his knife, folded it up, put it in his pocket, and left me standing in a pool of blood. Now, one does strange things when in a state of shock. Holding my side, I walked around, closed the windows, locked the doors, got in my car, drove to the hospital, got out, walked into the emergency room and said, "I've been stabbed. Where do you want me to go?" As it turned out, I was speaking to the chief physician of the hospital. She helped me onto a table where I promptly began to shake like a jackhammer. All that pent-up emotional trauma physically released. X-rays revealed the wound to be deep, but miraculously incised between the spleen and the lung, probably saving my life. 2 hours later, I lay in a hospital bed, struggling with my response to this physical assault. Part of my mind screamed, "Revenge." And part of my mind pleaded for forgiveness. As I struggled, the universe stepped in and demanded an immediate response. At that moment, I heard the screeching of tires on the street outside the window. As I raised myself to look out, I saw a pickup truck and a car slammed to a halt in front of the hospital. Both vehicles were loaded with men, and a pile of ropes lay in the back of the pickup. They all got out, milled around in angry conversation. Finally, a familiar face separated from the group and entered the hospital. He was a member of the congregation, as were they all. The news had traveled fast. I waited and finally heard heavy steps pounding down the corridor coming toward my room. He burst into the room and yelled, "Where is he? We're going to hang the son of a bitch. Don't protect him. We'll find him anyway." He had the same anger-reddened eyes as the deacon who had stabbed me. It was a temptation of magnitude, possibility of revenge. It required no encouragement on my part, only the refusal to not try to dissuade him from his mindset. But I knew that this lynch mob was about to commit an act that would wound their beings irreparably. And I knew that if I did not model the spirit of forgiveness and they succeeded with the intended lynching, I would share their guilt. I knew that. And at that moment, I opted for purging myself of the spirit of revenge and confronted this man with my decision. I reminded him of his own influence over the group of men gathered outside. I tried to get him to visualize the consequences of lynching this man on his family, the church, and the community. He left confused, and I watched out the window as he gathered the men, then engaged in a heated debate, and finally drove off. I later learned they had cruised the town looking for the deacon, but he had wisely hidden himself. A few days later, this brawny and a half-foot man who had burst into my hospital room wept quietly as he thanked me for dissuading him from carrying through the lynching scheme. But the story was not yet ended. A meeting of the congregation had been set for the next evening with the express purpose of condemnation and termination of the membership of the man who had stabbed me. I was still confined to the hospital, but I knew the time of the meeting. I also knew that the congregation needed to purge itself of its own spirit of revenge before it could resolve the conflict that had generated my stabbing. I knew that a further act of vengeance would only deepen the church's wounds and lessen the possibility of healing, and this meeting was the key. As the meeting was beginning, I put on my clothes, secretly slipped out of the hospital, drove to the meeting place, and crept into a back pew. Terrible, vindictive things were being said, and a motion was proposed to exclude this deacon from membership. I rose to speak, and the shock of my presence diffused this anger. I shared my own spirit of forgiveness and encouraged the congregation to act redemptively. Then something wonderful happened. People began to weep and quietly reach out to each other in forgiveness, not just toward the deacon, but toward each other, in an attempt to begin healing the conflict that had inspired my stabbing. Now, do I look like a saint? I've never been a saint. I'm not now. Where's my wife? She's here someplace. Am I a saint? Well, I married her for honesty, for one thing. Now, what I do know, beyond a doubt, is that there are decisive moments in our lives, whatever our age might be, when we are called upon to rise above our baser elements and touch those graces within us that not only redeem ourselves, but those around us. This was such a moment in my life. I can only be grateful that I had the wit to respond positively, for hindsight tells me that had I not done so, my own being would have been permanently damaged. Instead, I glean lessons from this experience that have served me as counselors throughout my life. And here are five of them. You can get out your pencils and paper. The first lesson became clear to me when I was forced to confront my own responsibility to society. The deacon had committed a crime not only against me, but against the society of which I'm a part. The laws of my society designed to make safe living possible had been violated. And these laws were not dismissed simply because I had forgiven the offender. I owed society my support of its system of justice. It became clear to me that forgiveness is not an act of justice. It is an act of self and social respect. Forgiveness cannot guarantee that the offender will respond with regret and an alteration of behavior. Being a recipient of forgiveness may open the offender to the possibility of moral transformation, but only time can reveal the reality of such possibility having been engaged. The deacon had attempted to rob me of my most basic human right, the right to live. The fact that he had done so in a fit of mindless passion did not alter this violation. If I wished for merciful consideration, the place to make such an appeal was within the system of justice. To refuse to support the process of justice because of forgiveness would be to mock the ideals upon which the system was grounded. Justice asked for the deacon to be accountable to society for an action that jeopardized my welfare and the safety of the larger community. To substitute forgiveness for this accounting would be to reduce justice to the caprice of sentimentality. While forgiveness denies the claim of personal revenge, it does not preclude the claims of social justice. And with these understandings, the lesson became clear to me, and here it is. Forgive, but do justice. I testified before an investigating grand jury in support of an indictment for attempted manslaughter. I asked this jury for social accountability. Second lesson I learned has to do with remembering and forgetting. We're all familiar with the old adage, forgive and forget, right? Forgive and forget. We're told that our whole lives, right? This personal experience told me that forgiving is an act of wisdom, while forgetting is an act of foolishness. I forgave the deacon who stabbed me, but to forget the circumstance that provoked this forgiveness would be to nullify both the experience and its lessons. Learning requires memory. I remember the lessons because I remember the triggering events. Plutarch's insight is apropos. Forgetfulness transforms every occurrence into a non-occurrence. I may forgive one who has been untrustworthy, but to forget the act that announced the trustworthiness is only to open myself to further betrayal. It is to invest in the illusion that the present can be lived wisely without remembering the past. It is to condemn myself to reinventing every wheel that is necessary for successful living. And as Aeschylus says in Prometheus Bound, memory is the mother of wisdom. Paulo Coelho summarizes nicely. Forgive, but do not forget, or you will be hurt again. Forgiving changes perspectives. Forgetting loses the lesson. And here's the lesson. Forgive, but don't forget. The third lesson is about revenge and pain. Revenge blinds me to how I can stop the psychological pain inflicted by an act of violence. This blindness is caused by a focus on external source. If such pain were an arrow in my leg, revenge would tell me that the way to stop hurting is to break the bow from which the arrow came. In actuality, the first step in healing such pain would be to remove the arrow from my leg. Otherwise, the arrow continued to inflict greater pain. Just so, if I expect to cure the psychological pain inflicted by violence, I must first remove the spirit of vengeance which keeps the wound from healing. Removing the arrow for me was forgiving the deacon so I could heal the pain caused by his action. Francis Bacon was right. A man that studieth revenge keeps his own wounds green. Just degenderize that quote, okay? You just got through singing about it, right? Revenge also may blind us to the real target of our concern. I was not the deacon's real target. I was an innocent bystander. But the senior minister who was the real target was not immediately available. And I had separated the minister from the deacon's availability. In his vengeful blindness, the deacon was unable to distinguish between us two. Vindictiveness becomes so consuming it may blind itself to the real target. The knife the deacon wielded was only 7 inches long and was wielded for only a split second. Yet its effect was the same as an army of blades indiscriminately slashing through the entire social environment. Wounded me, wounded the church, it wounded the community. It's an example of the compounded harm that can come from a blind act of vengeance. Seneca once observed that revenge is a confession of pain. Here's the lesson. When I dwell on revenge, I give my life to pain. Psychological pain multiplies itself in devotion to its blindness. Here's the fourth lesson. The deacon's vengeance toward the senior minister that resulted in my stabbing not only wounded his family, it destroyed his reputation in both the church and the community. Actually, he had to leave the community. He had to move his family. One moment he was a leader, the next he was a social pariah. The price of his moment of vengeance was immeasurable, and the irony was that the real target, the senior minister, was unscathed. But the personal destruction of revenge has little to do with success or failure of its game plan. It is obvious that the deacon had premeditated enough about his fury toward the senior minister to be carrying a 7-inch pocket knife, which when opened is comparable to a 12-inch butcher knife. And I often wonder what might have happened had I not stepped between them and moved them in opposite directions. I assume he was already invested in the blindness of destruction. As Karen Horney observes, every vindictiveness damages the core of my whole being. I'm also aware that I cannot escape damage to my own being when revenge is enacted without my objection. As I lay in the hospital bed, I knew that unless I sincerely opposed the vengeful intentions of the lynch party, my own being would be damaged. Meanness of spirit is no less damaging than the vindictive act. Harry Stein sums it up in his book entitled Ethics and Other Liabilities. He says, "The fact is, vindictive behavior and meanness of spirit finally make us as small as those we despise. Even when we manage to hurt others as we have been hurt, we succeed in a real sense only in further victimizing ourselves." This lesson is as old as human experience. Here are just a few ways it has been said. I had a list, and I cut them down to three. I had a list of 25 quotations. I figured these three would make the point. A Chinese proverb: the one who pursues revenge should dig two graves. John Ford, you know who John Ford is, the Western. Revenge proves its own executioner. And from Philip Massinger, revenge, that thirsty dropsy of our souls, which makes us covet that which hurts us most. I recall a conversation with a young woman who was very loving and kind toward everyone, irrespective. Yet she had a sister who was increasingly vindictive toward her in many hateful ways. There was no understandable reason for this behavior. And this young woman returned every hateful action with kindness. She said of her sister to me, "She sits there drinking poison, hoping that the poison she drinks will kill me." I have learned that drinking the poison of revenge only brings the worst of the past into the present while causing me to lose the best of the future. I have learned that blowing out someone else's candle does not make mine burn brighter. The lesson is, vindictive behavior and meanness of spirit are always personally destructive. The lesson is, vindictive behavior and meanness of spirit are always personally destructive. The last lesson is about lifestyle. Forgiveness is one of the most difficult issues we humans face. We live in a world full of deliberately imposed destruction on innocent people. How easy to be vindictive. Forgiveness touches on our capacity for nobility. Isn't that what we all strive for in our faith? Harry Stein presents the lesson when he summarizes what is at stake in making the choice between vengeance and forgiveness. Here's what he says. Living well is the best revenge. He also suggests that living well means to be at peace with oneself. Being at peace is a state of non-alienation, a state of wholeness. When we achieve this state to whatever extent possible, our tendency is to bridge the chasms that separate us, and forgiveness is such a bridge. Being ready to forgive is a symptom of being at peace with oneself. Such a state of peace reminds me of an admonition by John Southard. The only people with whom you should try to get even are those who have helped you. Most of my encounters with the issue of revenge have given me enough time to consider the consequences of wrong choices. However, this early experience required immediate choices. I had no time to ponder. I feel extraordinarily grateful to those who had influenced me sufficiently that I made what I perceived to be right calls in the face of immediate demand. I feel even more grateful for the lessons I've learned from the experience that has served me so well on my life journey. Now, while I learned these lessons in a conservative religious environment, they have no concern for any particular human context. They are universal. I've deliberately used quotes from the past and the secular world to attest to this universality. They are part of the wisdom of history, which is the legacy of all humans. They exist because this wisdom has empowered those of our past to live victoriously enough to pass on what they have learned, or as Paul Boise reminds us, forgiveness does not change the past, but it does enlarge the future. Here are the lessons. Forgive, but do justice. Forgive, but don't forget. When I dwell on revenge, I give my life to pain. Vindictiveness is always destructive. Living well is the best revenge. In handing down these lessons, our ancestors also handed down the choices that taught them. If we choose revenge, we opt for its destructive consequences. If we choose forgiveness, we opt for its redemptive consequences. and to remind us of the consequence of wrong choosing, the Greeks devised this proverb. It's pictorially diagrammed on the cover of your order of service. Don't look at it right now. Look at it after I give you the proverb. Here it is. The camel set out to get him horns and was shorn of his ears. Amen.